Hey, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241. It is November 18th, and what button did I push right here? We're good. It's the 18th, and we're going to finish up blood, heart, and circulation today, and then move on to the next chapter. And let's see, what chapter is that? Anybody remember what chapter that is? 12, the one that we're in right now? 13. Yep, we're going to finish 13 and then go on to 14 later this week. All right, so we're going to finish that up. But before we get started, do we have any news from SI?
Yes. Hello, everyone. Just a reminder, sessions will be canceled this Thursday. It will resume next Tuesday, same time, same location, but it will be canceled on Thursday because Thursday is Thanksgiving. So make sure you guys come out next Tuesday and start reviewing for the final exam. And also another announcement is, if you would like to become an SI leader for this class for next semester, please come talk to me or come talk to Dr. Gober. It is a paid position. You get a lot of, it's a learning experience. You learn how to communicate with your students, how to teach, how to facilitate in a classroom-based setting. It's a really good experience,
so if you would like more
information, feel free to
contact me as well as Dr. Gober. And I believe they will start taking applications soon
as well. So think about it, and if you have any questions, let us know. I got a quick question. Yes. Do you get paid by the hour that you participate, yes. Right? You get paid for holding your sessions, for prepping for your sessions, and coming to lecture as well.
Do you know what the base rate is for a new SI leader about?
The pay is different, I believe, for a person who holds a bachelor's degree and a person who doesn't. So if you hold a bachelor's degree, the pay is a lot higher, I believe, and it is above the minimum wage, which is pretty good for the pay from a school.
Right.
Yeah.
Nice.
So about, any more questions, come
on. About how many hours a week do you...
About 10 to 12 hours a week.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. So come out, please. Come talk to me. I don't like.
Any questions? Okay. No, but you will after you teach the SI. You have to be comfortable with the information so that you feel like you can explain it. That would be helpful. Okay. It's probably the best way I could think of answering that question. All right, so then just going back to the schedule, all right, what did we say today was? The 18th? Indeed. So your last exam is on December 11th. That's 1, 2, 3.5 weeks away. And we're going to put chapter 13 on that test as well. All right, so we know what the schedule is. All right, so what were we looking at last time? We were looking at blood. We learned some special properties of blood, right? That if you mix different blood types together, you get a transfusion reaction. What do we call that transfusion reaction? And I want you to know something about the mechanism there. What kind of reaction is it? What does the reaction produce? I guess that's a better way of asking that. What does it produce? A transfusion reaction. It produces, the pathological condition is called agglutination, right? Agglutination. And what kind of reaction is agglutination? It had two pieces. It's an antibody-antigen reaction. Yeah, agglutination, antigen, antibody. And where do you find the antigens? They're always going to be located. Antigens are always located... It's on the surface of the red blood cell, the cell membrane of a red blood cell. And where are you always going to find antibodies? Yeah, they're soluble in blood. All right, so antibodies are floating around in blood. Antigens are on the cell surface. And when they match up, they will bind to each other. And if there's a mismatch in blood, then the antibodies will bind to the red blood cells. One antibody can bind two different red blood cells, so these red blood cells are going to just all clump together. We call that agglutination. And then eventually they're going to lyse. All right, what is lysis of a cell? What does that mean? Is that good or bad? What happens during lysis? Like glycolysis is what? The breaking down of something. So it's the breaking down of a cell. So agglutination causes the breakdown of all those red blood cells, the lysis of them. All right, so agglutination is an antibody-antigen reaction. What was another reaction that we looked at? Coagulation. Yeah, coagulation. Oh, look, that's the slide that I'm showing you right here. How would you best describe coagulation? You describe agglutination as antibody-antigen reaction. What about coagulation? Is that antibody-antigen reaction? It is fibrin formation. Fibrin formation. Yep. So we talked about that. Two different kinds of principles right there. We talked about this, the clotting pathways, the extrinsic, intrinsic, common pathways. And just as a really quick review, what ion is necessary in order for to have normal blood clotting function? What ion is necessary?
Calcium.
Calcium, that's right, calcium. So calcium is good for another function. Okay, what are some other things? What are some other things that have to be available besides calcium? It's a phospholipids, and that's okay because as soon as you damage a cell membrane, there are phospholipids floating around as well. All right, so that's what we're talking about, the disruption of the endothelium of a blood vessel or cutting through a blood vessel. Okay, and we also looked at some terms that have an ogen at the end of them, or maybe a pro at the beginning. So if you run into a word with an ogen on the end, what does that mean? That means that it's a molecule that has a function, but the function is not active, right? So this is a precursor to an active molecule. Like fibrinogen is the precursor to fibrin. Fibrin is what makes a clot appear. Right, that's what allows for coagulation. And if you ever run into a term with a pro, again, that means inactive, right? And it can be converted into an active form very quickly. Same thing with fibrinogen. It's inactive, but can be converted very quickly into the active form. All right. The other thing that you should know about fibrinogen and fibrin, one is soluble and the other is a precipitate. Which one is the precipitate? Not everyone has taken chemistry, but what does precipitation mean?
It forms a solid.
At one point in time, it was all in solution, and then all of a sudden, this molecule, right, comes out of solution, and maybe it falls to the bottom of the test tube. Maybe it forms a crystal, but it can no longer dissolve in that fluid. That's what a precipitate is. All right, so fibrinogen and fibrin, which one is the precipitate? Fibrin, that's the molecule that cannot dissolve in plasma any longer. It precipitates, right? And so when you look, and fibrinogen does dissolve in plasma, which is mostly water. When fibrinogen gets converted to a fibrin by thrombin, of course, you see right here, right? It precipitates fibrin, and this is what fibrin looks like, right? This network. So fibrin is just a protein that has been converted from fibrinogen. It can no longer stay in solution, but it forms this precipitate, and as you can see, it's a special kind of precipitate because what does it look like? How would you describe? It forms a net, right? It forms a mesh or a network, and it traps platelets and red blood cells and white blood cells as they try to flow through a cut in a blood vessel. Right, and so it forms these big plugs that closes off a damage to a blood vessel. All right, so here we see something, and so I want you to answer this question. Coagulation is what formation? Fibrin formation, not antibody antigen, but it's when fibrinogen gets converted to fibrin, and then it precipitates out of solution, and it makes this nice network right here. Okay, and when that happens, then your blood turns from a liquid into a solid, and it can no longer flow anymore. Well, coagulation is important when you have damage to a blood vessel, but if you cut your finger, it's really nice so that you have a clot forming over that cut, but would you like to have a blood clot in that same finger but on the other side of your body? Say you cut your index finger on your left hand. Would it be advantageous to have a blood clot on the index finger of your right hand? No, you only want it where there is damage, right? And as a matter of fact, you don't want a blood clot in any of the neighboring fingers or the hand or the elbow, right? So there's got to be a mechanism that makes sure that the blood clot only stays in the area where it's necessary and that the blood in your body doesn't coagulate everywhere, because then there won't be any blood flowing anywhere. So there are some things, right, that are antagonistic to coagulation. Or when a blood vessel is repaired, that blood clot should be dissolved away. And kallikrein is a molecule that converts plasminogen. And what can you tell me about plasminogen? It's inactive, so it's floating in your blood all the time. Kallikrein converts plasminogen into plasmin, and plasmin is an enzyme that can break fibrin down. All right, so it will dissolve fibrin, it will break it down into smaller pieces that can dissolve in blood, and then the clot is dissolved as a result of that. All right, so I think you should appreciate some antagonistic mechanisms, right? And that antagonism has to be there, because you don't want blood clotting all over in your body. And that can happen to some people, and it's really, really sad when that happens, okay, because it's not a good thing. So plasmin is something that breaks a clot down. Thrombin is the other enzyme that can make a clot, so you should appreciate that plasmin and thrombin have opposite effects. And I'm looking to see if I had a slide on this. Okay, I don't have a slide on this, but there is, besides kallikrein, there's another factor that can convert plasminogen to plasmin, and we can even use this clinically. It's called TPA, tissue plasminogen activator. Right, so it will create plasmin. And what does that plasmin, if we give tissue TPA to somebody, tissue plasminogen activator, okay, what's going to happen? Then clots will be dissolved in a person's body. And when would we like to dissolve a blood clot that somebody has? One might be a good... Yeah, for instance, if somebody's having a stroke, right, that means that blood is not going to a certain part of their brain. That part of their brain is going to die, and they'll lose whatever function that part of the brain is giving the individual. So if they're having a stroke and it's due to a blood clot with TPA, right, then a patient can get TPA and it can break that clot down before that part of the brain dies. So that's really interesting. That's really nice when that can happen. Okay, but for instance, there can be two reasons why somebody is having a stroke. One is due to a blood clot in a blood vessel that's going to the brain. And what might be another reason why blood isn't getting to a certain part in the brain? Because maybe there is, right, an aneurysm that breaks, or maybe there's a break in a blood vessel that's producing hemorrhage. So blood is leaking out into the brain. Blood isn't going to the part of the brain that we want to have blood going to. All right, so strokes can be due to a thrombus or a blood clot, or it could be due to a blood vessel damage. And do you think it would be a good idea to know which kind of stroke somebody is having before you give them a drug that will dissolve a clot down? Or doesn't it matter? Do you think it matters? Should diagnosis take place before you administer that therapy? Who thinks it maybe is a good idea? And why? Why do you think it's a good idea? Okay, well, because plasmin breaks down blood clots, and when somebody's bleeding, what do you need? You need blood clots to prevent that hemorrhage from happening, right? So if somebody's having a stroke, and then they're given something to break clots down, but they have bleeding in the brain, what does that make it? It makes the bleeding worse instead of better, right? So not every kind of hospital can administer that kind of therapy because they have to come up with a diagnosis first. All right, so if it's due to a blood clot, then TPA is a good drug to give somebody because it can break that clot down and maybe blood will return to that part of the brain that's going to die. But if they have a hemorrhage in the brain, then of course, right, you don't want to break those clots down. You would actually like to prevent even more blood loss in somebody's brain. Okay, So that's the importance of plasmin right here. There are times when we don't want blood to turn into a solid, we need to use anticoagulants. And sometimes, well, a lot of times, when you talk about these kinds of agents with people, they're called blood thinners, right? Blood thinners. And that's really a misnomer. That's a terrible thing to say. I say it sometimes, but I cringe when I say it because, right, these things don't thin the blood. What do? They work with these pathways, right, to prevent some kind of activity. So it's going to prevent fibrin formation. But these anticoagulants don't make your blood any thinner, right? They don't thin your blood. The osmolality of blood is still the same. Only these active mechanisms have been prevented. Like maybe here is heparin. That is a nice anticoagulant because it blocks this nice positive feedback mechanism that is necessary to have fast coagulation. All right, that reminds me. I have to mention something else. All right, so here we have tissue thromboplastin, right? That's an enzyme. It activates factor 7 right here. And when this thromboplastin activates one molecule of factor 7, what happens to it? What happens to tissue thromboplastin? Does it get used up in the reaction? No, right? Because enzymes don't get used up. So it can convert and convert over and over and over again. All right, so then here is factor 10, right? And there's an enzyme that converts an inactive 10 to an activated 10, right? And what happens to that enzyme if it, after it catalyzes the reaction, does it get used up? Okay, remember, enzymes never get used up with the reactions that they convert. Oh, here is the conversion of prothrombin to thrombin, right? A result of another enzyme, right? Does that enzyme get used up during the reaction? No, but it can catalyze that reaction over and over and over again. So what do we call it when we have a series of steps, of enzymatic steps, and each step is a step in amplification, right? Because this one enzyme can make many, many other enzymes, and those many enzymes can make many, many, many more enzymes activated. What do we call that when we have a series of steps, right, and that signal is amplified? What do we call that? That's a cascade mechanism, right? So I think that's probably the most important thing to take home with these different pathways for coagulation is that there is, it's a cascade mechanism. And what the heck does that mean? It means that a very small signal can produce a very large response, but it also means that it can happen fast, right? So it can happen fast. So coagulation is a relatively fast process, right, because of this cascade mechanism. All right, that's why I bothered to show you all that complicated stuff. All right, so what are some things that can be used as anticoagulants? Sometimes they're called blood thinners, but what are you going to do when you hear blood thinner? What are you going to do? I think I heard it. You're going to cringe. That's right, you're going to cringe. You're going to go, ooh, they're not blood thinners, right, because you know a whole lot more about coagulation now. All right, well, we said calcium is necessary, right? Can you see that in the different pathways, intrinsic and extrinsic pathways? If we take calcium out of the solution that blood is in, all right, then blood cannot coagulate because calcium is necessary. There are certain compounds that will bind specifically with calcium and take them out of solution, right? And we call these chelators. A chelator is a compound that can bind a metal ion and take it out of solution. Here are some. Sodium citrate is one. EDTA is another one. And sometimes we use, I don't know if you're going to use these, maybe use these in lab, okay, because if you want to keep blood a liquid, you put some of these, EDTA or sodium citrate in solution, and blood will always stay a liquid. It won't coagulate. We can't use these in people because you have important reasons why you want to have calcium in your body, right, for synaptic transmission and muscle contraction. If we put calcium chelators in somebody, right, they're going to die. But in a test tube, it's fine, right? All right. Heparin is another one, right? It activates this antithrombin 3, which blocks the formation of thrombin. And remember, that makes it participates, and this reaction right here participates in a positive feedback mechanism. Heparin blocks that positive feedback mechanism, so so that that cascade can't operate, and that's going to suppress clotting function. Coumarin is another one. Blocks clotting by inhibiting the activation of vitamin K, and vitamin K works indirectly by working on calcium levels. Right? But I have all of these things on that intrinsic and extrinsic pathway. Right, so these are anticoagulants. And do they work by thinning the blood? Yes. Okay. Do they work by thinning the blood? No. Because coumarin or coumadin, right, works by inhibiting the activation of vitamin K. It doesn't thin anything down, doesn't thin your blood. What about heparin? Doesn't thin your blood, right? But it activates antithrombin, which blocks the formation of thrombin. And of course, what is thrombin necessary for? Is fibrin formation, right? Thrombin is necessary to convert fibrinogen into fibrin. And that fibrin then precipitates out of solution. Okay. So in a glutenation, where do you always find antigens? Where do you find antigens in agglutination? As a matter of fact, where do you find antigens? On the cell surface, right? The cell membrane. So if somebody has an A antigen on the red blood cell surface, what kind of blood type do they have? Yeah, it's just by the antigen that they have on the red blood cell. So if they have an A antigen, they're type A. Right? If they have a B antigen, they're type B. And if they have both A and B, they are blood type? AB. And if there's no antigen, that they're O, right? And it just so happens when somebody's blood type A, they automatically produce antibodies against B. Right, so it goes the opposite way. And if somebody is AB, right, then they don't produce any antibodies. No antibodies for A or B. And if somebody's type O, there's no antigens, they automatically produce anti-A and anti-B at the same time. Okay. Well, let's proceed with the heart, and I got a couple quick questions for you. How many chambers does the heart have?
Four.
Four. Everybody knows that. Fantastic. How many valves does the heart have?
Four.
Okay. I just got to yell that out too. But it sounds like you need to review that a little bit. So how many chambers does the heart have?
Four.
Four. And how many valves does the heart have? Again, you want to say?
Four.
Yeah, you want to say four. So four and four. Okay. All right. And here's another question. Maybe you haven't thought about the heart this way. How many sides does the heart have?
Two.
I like two. I like two. What are their names?
Right.
Yeah, right and left. That's right. So the heart really is two pumps side by side, but they're glued together in one organ. So there's two sides to the heart. How many major circulations are there in the body?
Two.
There are two, right? Yeah, pulmonary and systemic, right? And that's why the heart has two sides, because the left side pumps blood through the systemic circulation and the right side pumps blood through the lungs or the pulmonary circulation. All right, so let's take a look at some stuff right here. Oh, here's a really good picture. I don't want to spend too much time on this, but I see all four chambers, and I see all four valves, and I see the two circulations, two sides of the heart. Okay, and here is a blood vessel right here. And I see that it is delivering blood to the heart. It's delivering blood to the heart. Is that an artery or a vein? Artery or vein? It's nice red. It's a nice red blood vessel. Is that an artery?
Artery.
I hear artery. But, okay, we got to go over the definitions. An artery is a blood vessel that takes blood away from the heart. Okay, and it doesn't matter what color it is on an illustration, which means it doesn't matter if it's high or low in oxygen. So here is a vessel bringing blood back to the heart. This is a vein, and is it labeled? Oh, look at that. It was even labeled. Pulmonary vein. Okay. Here I see a couple blood vessels right next to each other, and I see the arrows are taking blood away from the heart. So, but they're two different colors. One is red, one is blue. Right? Are they both going to be arteries, both veins, or is one an artery and one a vein? One and one? Both of these, right, just by the direction of blood flow, blood is flowing away from the heart. Both of these are arteries. Right? Both are arteries, and one is relatively high in oxygen. That's the systemic artery, and that's the aorta. Here is the pulmonary artery, and that's taking blood away from the heart once again. But where's that blood going? It's going to the lungs to pick up oxygen. All right, so the circulations, the pulmonary and systemic circulations, are opposite to each other in terms of what their function is, in terms of oxygen. All right, so the pulmonary circulation, arteries are low in oxygen, veins are high. For systemic circulation, arteries are high in oxygen, veins are low in oxygen. All right, but a vein is always going to bring blood back to the heart. All right, and so we talk about arteries and veins. What's the last kind of blood vessel do I see here? And okay. We got arteries, got veins. What else do we have on this slide? We got capillaries, and they're so small. Why are we concerned about capillaries? Is there anything special happening there? Yeah, capillaries are necessary for exchange, right? So that's really kind of the whole ball game right there. Capillaries are thin enough so that whatever in blood can diffuse out, right? Or if there's a high concentration of something outside the capillary, it can diffuse in. Right, so that's the significance of capillaries, exchange. So the walls of veins, the walls of arteries, are way too thick to allow for diffusion or to allow for exchange. So if something's in the blood over here, it's trapped, can't get out. Even though, right, it might be oxygen and you want that oxygen to go to tissues, it's just trapped. Okay, I don't think I want to talk much about this, but sometimes people forget what the definition of an artery and a vein is. I wanted to make sure I went over that. All right, and you see the two circulations, systemic and pulmonary circulation. Of these two circulations, it's not shown on this diagram, but which one is more extensive? Which one has longer blood vessels? Is it the pulmonary or systemic circulation? Yeah, systemic, right? These blood vessels are very long. And the length of a blood vessel determines what the resistance of that blood vessel is. So that means that the left side of the heart, since it's pumping blood a lot further distance than the pulmonary, right, the left side of the heart has to be a lot stronger, about 5 times as strong, because those blood vessels are much longer, the resistance is much higher. Left ventricle has to be a lot stronger. All right, rate of blood flow. Oh, here is a good, I put it in red. Here's a pretty important concept. Maybe you just have to memorize. So we have blood flowing through the systemic circulation. Here we have blood flowing through the pulmonary circulation. And what about the flow of blood? Flow is a volume of time, an amount of blood. Volume is like a milliliter, right? And it's the amount of blood that is moved for a certain period of time through a blood vessel. What should you think about the blood flow through the pulmonary artery compared to the blood flow through the aorta, or the blood flow through the right side of the heart compared to the left side of the heart? Should they be different, or should they be the same, or doesn't it really matter? Okay, well, let's just say, I like your answers, but let's just say that the left ventricle is pumping twice as much blood compared to the right ventricle. What's going to happen to that blood? It's going to back up someplace, right? It's going to back up in the systemic capillaries, right? Because the right side of the heart can't keep up with the left side. So in the normal heart, the left side of the heart has to pump the same amount of blood as the right side, so that blood doesn't get stuck someplace in either of these circulations. So over a certain period of time, relatively long period of time, right? The right and left side of the heart has to pump the same amount of blood. The reason why that one is strong and one is weak is because the left ventricle has to pump blood a lot farther compared to the right ventricle, which is only a short distance. So the rate of flow through the systemic circulation must equal the rate of flow through the pulmonary circulation. Right? Maybe not instant to instant, but in the period maybe of a minute or a couple minutes, unless there's something changing, which maybe we'll talk about. Okay, we talked about two different sides of the heart, the valves. How many valves are there once again? Yeah, just like the number of chambers. And we can break them down into two groups. Anybody know what the two groups are? Okay, mitral is a nice name of a valve. Another name for mitral is bicuspid. And what kind of valve is a bicuspid valve? Okay, here's an atrium, here's a ventricle, and I see the nice mitral valve right here. The valve, this mitral valve, is between an atrium and a ventricle, so we call that an atrioventricular valve. Right? It prevents retrograde flow of blood from a ventricle back up into this atrium. It should close very nice. Right? And don't forget about the right side of the heart. Here's another atrioventricular valve between the right atrium and right ventricle. But we can't call this one the bicuspid, right? Because bicuspid's over here. Right? This one has three leaflets or flaps. The one on the left only has two. Hence, that's called the bicuspid or mitral valve. So what are you going to call the one on the right side of the heart? Yeah, because it has three flaps. It's the tricuspid. And if you don't see three flaps, how are you going to remember that the tricuspid is over here on the right, bicuspid on the left? Because you look at the heart and you go, try before you buy. All right, so maybe that will help you sometime. All right, well, that's two. Where else do we have valves? At the base or the root of the great arteries coming off the base of the heart, right? And so here is the pulmonary trunk or pulmonary artery. Here is the pulmonary valve. That's not an AV valve, right? We call this a semilunar valve. And then at the base of the, or the root of the aorta, there is another valve. That's the aortic semilunar valve. So there are two semilunar valves, two atrioventricular valves. And just make sure you know where those are, because we're going to talk about some of these functions. Only the AV valves have papillary muscles and corded tendineae attached to them to prevent them from flopping back and forth. So I can see the semilunar valves here and here. They have both have three cusps. And notice that the pulmonary and aortic semilunar valves are very similar, right? Extremely similar. And then here are the atrial ventricular valves. They're sort of similar, but you see one has two and the other has three. All right, the cardiac cycle. So make sure you review all of that good stuff. Cardiac cycle. Well, the heart is a pump, right? So it's designed to pump blood. It pumps up fluid. How is fluid going to move from one place to another? How does it move? You know diffusion. How does diffusion work? Things go where for diffusion? High concentration to low concentration. Right. Now, how does a fluid move? Is due to a difference in blood pressure, it will flow from high pressure to low pressure. That's how it's going to flow, right? So it's the job of the heart to pressurize blood so that the heart is very high pressure, right? And then it's going to flow through the blood vessels because the veins have very low pressure. So blood is going to flow through your vascular system, okay? All right, so the heart is a pump. It pressurizes blood, but it's not like an electric pump that we might be familiar with. Electric pump is pumping all the time, and the heart doesn't pump all the time. Sometimes it pumps, sometimes it relaxes, right? And then it pumps again, and then it relaxes. We call that a reciprocating pump. And it's very fast, right? So when the heart is actually contracting and pumping, we call that systole, right? So that refers to the contraction phase, right? And then the heart relaxes. We call that diastole. That refers to the relaxation phase. All right, so which one of these do you think is more important, contraction or relaxation? Contraction. Yeah, that's a good guess. That's a really good guess. And for decades and maybe hundreds of years, everybody thought that was real important. But you know what? If the heart doesn't relax, guess what can't happen? Blood can't flow into the heart. And if blood can't flow in because it doesn't relax, when the heart beats again, what is it beating on? What is it pumping? Nothing. Right, so relaxation is just as important as contraction. Right, so understanding systolic function is just as important as understanding diastolic function, because we have filling of the ventricles during diastole. And that's necessary, that's a prerequisite in order for systole to pump blood out of the heart. Okay. Okay, so both atria contract together, followed by both ventricles a little bit later. We're going to look at the conduction system. So there is a reason why the atria contract together, and there's another reason why the ventricles contract together, right? Because these cells communicate with each other. What do we call the structural and functional unit of communication between cells? What do we call that? That's a synapse. I like that. I heard synapse out there somewhere. And how many major kinds of synapses are there? There are two. What are they? electrical and chemical, right? And so that chemical requires something like a neurotransmitter, right? But the cells in the heart have electrical synapses between them. So if one myocardial cell depolarizes, and what kind of signal is depolarization? Is that inhibition or excitation? That's excitation. So if one heart cell depolarizes, guess what happens to all of them? They all depolarize because they have gap junction, which is an electrical synapse, right? So that signal for excitation travels from one cell to the next, to the next, to the next. So both atria contract together. When we talk about blood pressure, we're always given two numbers. At least here in the United States, we're given two numbers, right? And here I see two, 120 over 80, which is, and this is measured in a unit of pressure called millimeters of mercury, right? If we have a tube and we have a little bit of mercury in this tube, it doesn't exert as much force at the bottom of the tube compared if we had a tube that was like two stories tall and filled it with mercury, right? It'd be a lot heavier at the bottom of that tube. So if you increase the millimeters of mercury in something, that increases the pressure. So it's just a measure of pressure. Here is 120 over 80. What the heck does that mean? I see two numbers. What does that refer to? The two phases of contraction, systole and diastole, and which one will have a higher pressure? When the heart is contracting, right? So the first number is systolic, the second number is diastolic, and 120 over 80 is normal blood pressure. Right, even for you guys sitting there right now, that is normal blood pressure. Some people say, well, it could be maybe 85, right? This, that, or the other. Well, that's really, you got to add these things both together, divide by two. There's various ways to analyze it, but you should probably just remember that 120 over 80 is normal blood pressure. And if it's 130 over 80, what do we call that? That's high blood pressure or hypertension. Okay. Well, this number has a tendency to drift up as we get older, indeed it does, but everybody should be shooting for these two numbers right here, because hypertension, right, will slowly destroy your heart and blood vessels and other organs in your body. So it's a really a terrible disease to have because you don't notice it. Okay, so that's the systemic blood pressure. And you probably know how to measure this blood pressure. Maybe in lab you will do that or have done that, but you put a pressure cuff around somebody's arm and inflate the pressure cuff, right, and that stops blood flow to their arm, and then you put a stethoscope on somebody's arm, and you release the pressure, and as blood starts to squirt back into the arm, you can hear that squirting, right, and when the squirting stops, then you know that's the diastolic pressure, right, and so we call that the auscultatory method for measuring blood pressure. So when we use that auscultatory method, what circulation are we measuring that pressure in? Only the systemic circulation, okay? Not the pulmonary circulation, because where's the pulmonary circulation? It's deep inside your thoracic cavity. It's very difficult to measure pulmonary blood pressure, right? But somebody could have systemic hypertension, they could have pulmonary hypertension as well, but it's very difficult to measure, right? The normal pulmonary blood pressure is about 25 over 10. Right, and that's lower pressure because the blood vessels are a lot shorter. It doesn't require as much energy to get through the pulmonary circulation compared to the systemic circulation. Okay, let's look at a couple of definitions. I see end-diastolic volume. All right, volume, and this is measured in milliliters. And so, what is this end-diastolic? What's diastolic mean? What is diastole? Relaxation, an end of relaxation, that is what? At the, when the heart has completely relaxed for a certain period of time and it's about ready to contract once again, that's the end of diastole, right before it contracts. All right, so end diastolic volume is just the amount of blood in the ventricles, right, after they fill up with blood, after they stretch out, right before they contract, end diastolic volume. All right. We can also measure the amount of blood that's left in the heart after it contracts. If the heart doesn't pump every last drop of blood out of it, right, there's still some residual blood left in the ventricle even after it contracts. We call that the end systolic volume, right? Amount of blood left in the ventricles at the end of systole. All right, so y'all familiar with systole? Systole is contraction, okay? Well, how much blood is pumped out of the heart every time it beats? We can look at the end diastolic volume and subtract the end systolic volume from it. And that will tell us what the stroke volume is every time the heart beats. All right, so which one of these volumes is bigger, end diastolic or end systolic volume of the heart? This is of the heart. Which one is bigger? I think I asked you bigger. Which one is a bigger volume, end diastole or end systole? End diastole, right? Because the heart is relaxing. It's filling up with blood, right? That's a large volume. End systole means what? The heart is contracting. The volume is getting smaller. The difference between those two volumes has to go somewhere, right? It gets pumped out of the heart. That's what we call the stroke volume, right? These two. All right, so which is larger, ESV or EDV? EDV, end diastolic volume. All right, what is the stroke volume if the ESV is 20 and the EDV is 80? What is that? How? Just tell me the formula. You don't have to do it in your mind. It is one minus the other, right? It is 80, right? That's the end diastolic volume, minus 20. So how much? How many mLs got pumped out of the heart? That's 60 mLs. Yeah, 60 milliliters is the stroke volume. All right, so if you want to bring a calculator to the next test, that's fine with me, okay? Okay, cardiac cycle. I just want to show you the graph that's in your study guide, and I'm going to talk about all these things as we look at that illustration. Here it is from your textbook. This one is okay. This is what we call a Wiggers diagram. All right, but I like the one that's in your lab manual a whole lot better. So I'm going to close this program down and look at the one that's in your lab manual. And I think I have that right here. I do. It's on the wrong screen, so I got to come over here and I go like this. Okay. And I've modified it because the one in your lab manual is maybe a little flaky. All right, and so because it's hard to tell sometimes, where's my cursor? Ah, here it is. Sometimes it's hard to tell, like this thing right here where I have the cursor, sometimes it's hard to tell if this is a zero or an O, right? And so it's really hard to tell in your book. And sometimes the valves aren't really clearly labeled, so I relabeled it so that it makes perfectly good sense for you. All right, so what do we have here? What is this thing? This is it's a graph. And in order to understand a graph, what do we have to look at first? First, the axes, all right? Well, it looks complicated, but one axis is really simple. The one down over here, the horizontal axis is just time, right? And we see it in seconds, right? So here's 200 milliseconds, here's 400, right? So it's just a time. You could draw a little arrow here if you want to make sure that you see arrow is progressing as you move to the right. Now, what about the vertical axis? There are a number of them, okay? This first one down over here, we're just going to look at sound intensity. So we have sound intensity versus time, right? And so the heart makes sounds when it's doing its job. And how many sounds on this illustration do you see? Yeah, there are two. There's two heart sounds that you have to know about in this class. The next graph is a plot of the electrical activity, all right, on the surface of somebody's body that's due to the heart versus time, right? And the sound and this electrical activity have been put in the exact same time axis so that if we know where one is happening, we can look and see where the other one is happening in the same time. So we got sound, we have electrical activity, and the next graph is, who can tell me what the next graph is? It's something versus time. It is volume versus time, and the volume that we're going to be looking at here is the volume of a ventricle, and if you want to pick the left ventricle, that's fine with me, right? So we got ventricular volume, right? And then the last axis, right? You're going to love this, so too bad there's only one axis that's left. It's not volume, this is pressure versus time, and during time, what we're going to look at is one complete heart cycle. So one cycle where the heart is relaxed and then followed by when the heart is contracting. All right, so let's look at these. All right, this electrical activity sometimes we call the electrocardiogram on the surface of somebody's body. All right, so where do we want to start? Let's start with pressure, okay? And how does fluid flow once again? Fluid is going to flow, blood is a fluid, gases, a fluid. How does it flow from high pressure to low pressure? That's going to move blood around, right? And the heart is pumping, it's pressurizing blood. All right, well, let's look at this top dotted line. I see that it is decreasing, and then all of a sudden it increases. And then it starts to decrease once again, and guess what's going to happen again? It's going to increase, right? So here is a measure of blood pressure in an artery, say the aorta. So here is arterial pressure. And what is the peak pressure that we see with this dotted line right here? What's the peak pressure? Can you see it on the slide? Oh, I hope you can read it. I can read it. Can you guys read that number? Yeah, you can read that. So where's the peak blood pressure? Right here. And what is it numerically? It is 120. What's the lowest blood pressure? I see it right here. Oh, I see it right over here, because then it starts to rise again. What pressure is that? 80. Is that normal blood pressure? How would you talk about this pressure? It is what? What is this pressure of this person? If somebody, yeah, it's normal, okay? But numerically, how would you describe this to somebody? What's their blood pressure? 120 over 80, right? Just like what we said. Systolic over diastolic. You don't have to do any fancy calculations. You can just read it off the graph. Okay. So this 120 is during what? When? During relaxation or contraction? Contraction, right? So that's systolic. And then over here, this is diastolic pressure. And then all of a sudden, all right, so we have diastolic, during diastole, the heart fills with blood. The pressure inside the aorta starts to decrease. And then it starts to increase. What's happening when it's increasing here? The heart is beginning to contract, right? So here's some initial phase of contraction, this initial phase of systole. All right, and if we look down to this volume, there's chemists up there. If we look at the volume of a ventricle, okay, here's when the ventricle starts to contract, right? So what volume of the ventricle is this? So here's diastole. This is where diastole stops. So, and here we're looking at volume. What volume is this? Yeah, that is end diastolic volume. So end diastolic volume. After the heart contracts all the way over here, then the heart starts to relax. All right, and look what happens to the volume of the ventricle. It starts large, right, and then kind of levels off. So what volume of the ventricle is this right here? It looks like a Q. That is the end systolic volume, because that's when? That's at the end of systole. All right, so if we want, could you calculate stroke volume by looking at this graph? You could, because it is just what? End diastolic volume minus end systolic volume. It's this volume right here. It looks like, what, like maybe 120 minus 60, pretty close, right? And this is in milliliters. Okay. Notice there are a couple places here where the volume of the ventricle doesn't change. Do you see it real flat right here? The volume is not changing. And then also, right over here, the volume is not changing very much. So blood can neither enter or leave the ventricles during these two parts of the cardiac cycle that we call isovolumetric. Isovolumetric means the same volume. Here is isovolumetric contraction that happens when the ventricles contract. Here is isovolumetric relaxation, because now the ventricles are relaxing. Okay, so if we have a room like this room right here, and we have a bunch of people from the hallway want to get in, but they can't get in, right? And we have a bunch of people in the room, and you guys want to get out, but you can't get out. What can you tell me about that room? Nobody can enter or leave. What can you tell me about, what's something special about that room? All the doors are closed, right? If all the doors are closed, then nobody can enter and nobody can leave. But fortunately, they never get locked. Same thing for the heart, right? If blood can't enter or leave, the volume stays the same. That means all the doorways are closed. What are the doorways in the heart? They are the valves, right? So during these periods of isovolumetric contraction or relaxation, Here is when all of the valves are closed. How many valves does a heart have?
Four.
Remember, there's atrioventricular valves. Both of them are closed. It has semilunar valves. Both of those are closed during this period of time. All right, so that's what we want to look at next. Why do these valves open or close? And it has to do with the way that blood will want to flow across the valve. Valves are passive. They just open or close depending on how blood is going to push them. Okay, so down over here, so here is the dotted line is pressure in the aorta, and we can see it goes from, 120 down to 80, then 120 once again. And this line right smack in the middle, this is the pressure inside of an atrium. Here's atrial pressure. The bottom line is pressure in the ventricle. And we can see that pressure in a ventricle goes from what? From 0 to 120, right? It's not like this artery right here that goes from 120 to 80 or 80 to 120. It actually goes to 0, right? And here is the pressure in an atrium. All right, so the pressure in the atrium is slowly increasing as it fills up with blood. Remember, this is diastole, so the heart is relaxed, blood is flowing in, it's filling up the chambers. Right, and then the atria contracts by this, I see this little bump right here, the pressure increases inside the atrium. Right, but now, right at this time, the ventricles start to contract, and the pressure inside the ventricle skyrockets. Right, so over here, we see higher pressure in an atrium, lower pressure in a ventricle. High pressure atrium, low pressure in ventricle. Which way is blood going to flow? Tell me in terms of high to low. Which way is blood going to flow? High to low. So what's higher, atrium or ventricle on this graph? Atrium. So which way is blood going to flow? Atrium to ventricle. Right, so that's going to help filling the ventricle up. Now, right at this point in time, the pressure is exactly the same, right? So blood is not going to flow one way or the other. But the instant right after this point in time, the blood in the ventricle is what? A lot higher than the pressure in an atrium. So over here, which way is blood going to want to flow? Which way does it go? High to low? What's higher, ventricular pressure or atrial pressure? Ventricular pressure. So blood is going to want to go from a ventricle into an atrium. Is that allowed?
No,
because that would be going backwards. We call that retrograde. There's something that prevents that retrograde flow. And what is that inside the heart that prevents backward flow of blood? That's a valve. Okay, and what's that valve between a ventricle and an atrium? Yeah, that's an AV valve, atrioventricular valve. And let's just say this is the left side of the heart. Which one is that? That is the mitral or bicuspid valve. So this little, I can't read that letter, maybe it looks like an I, right where these pressures cross over, there's something happening there, a valve is closing, and it is the atrioventricular valve. So here the mitral valve is closing. Okay, and when a valve closes, it makes a noise. It slams closed. Just like if you were to take that door and slam it closed, it makes a noise. So when this valve closes, we would expect to hear something. Do we see that on the sound diagram? Yes. We call that the first heart sound. So what causes the first heart sound? Closure of the AV valves. Right, so you don't have to memorize it because it tells you right here on this graph. That's really nice. Okay. Okay. And also, just for your information, we're going to look at this to prove it to you. Also, and at this time, right after the AV valve closes, the semilunar valve is closed. So the AV valves are closed, the semilunar valves are closed. So what's happening to the volume of the ventricle if all the valves are closed? It stays the same. Blood can't enter or leave, right? As soon as this AV valve closes, that starts this isovolumetric contraction of the heart. Right? That's why we have this here. All right, so the ventricle starts to contract more and more and more and more. And let's compare it with the aorta. So here's pressure in the aorta, here in the left ventricle. And which way does blood flow once again? High to low. What's higher, pressure in the aorta or pressure in the ventricle right here? Aorta. So blood will want to flow. Blood will want to flow from where? Aorta to a ventricle. Is that allowed to happen? Should it go from the artery back into the heart? That's retrograde. That's backwards. Blood shouldn't flow that way. What's preventing that from happening? A valve, right? And that is the aortic semilunar valve. So in this period of time, right, the AV valve is closed and the aortic valve is closed. That produces what? This isovolumetric contraction. But right at this point in time, okay, I see now pressure in the left ventricle higher than the aorta. So which way is blood going to flow here? High in the ventricle, low in the aorta. It's always going to go from high to low. Where is it higher? Higher in the ventricle or higher in the aorta? Higher in the ventricle, so blood is going to squirt out from the ventricle into the aorta. Right, and so now we see the pressure in the aorta decreasing, but it's going to flow through that valve. So right here, right, is when, right at the end of isovolumetric contraction, this is when the semilunar valve opens so that blood can flow from the ventricle into the aorta. All right, so this is opening of the semilunar valve. All right, and then we got systole. The pressure is kind of equalized between the ventricle and the aorta, but then the heart starts to relax and the pressure starts to decrease in the, what are we looking at here? Where is this pressure at? Starts to decrease. Look, it is 40, 30, 10, 9. It's going to 0. Where is this pressure located? You ever have 0 pressure in a blood vessel? Like the aorta, ever have 0? No, you have 120 over 80. Okay, here's way below, 120 over 80. Where is this blood pressure? This is in the ventricle. Right, so here is the pressure in the ventricle starting to decrease. Now it gets below the pressure in the aorta. Right, and guess what happens? For which way does blood want to flow? Now we have high pressure in the aorta, low in the ventricle. Which way is blood going to want to flow? Aorta to ventricle. It will want to flow from aorta to ventricle, but can it do that in a normal heart? No, because there's a valve that's going to close to prevent that backward flow of blood. Right? So here is where the semilunar valve closes. Here's where it opens. Here's where it closes. Right? Okay, so here's opening of the aortic semilunar valve. So the pressure in the ventricle can decrease, but we don't have to worry about losing blood in the aorta. It can't get back into the heart. Right? It takes a little bit of energy to close that aortic valve, and so that's why I see this little drop in blood pressure in the aorta, and then it goes back up. We call that the dicrotic notch. That just represents the energy that's necessary to close the valve. Right? And then the heart is relaxing, and so we see decreased pressure in the aorta during diastole. Right, the last thing on this curve, which I haven't talked about, is let's go back and compare, right, the pressure in the atrium. So here's atrial pressure and the ventricle. Let's look right here. Well, I tell you what, we got over here and we saw that pressure in the ventricle is higher than the atrium that closes the AV valve when pressure in the ventricle is higher than the atrium. Right, so nothing has really happened. Here we have ventricular pressure. Here we have atrial pressure. Which way is blood going to want to flow in terms of the ventricle and atrium? What's high? Ventricular pressure. What's low? Atrial pressure. Blood will want to flow from ventricle to atrium, but can it? Not if there is a competent AV valve there that's going to prevent that flow. So the AV valve is still closed, still closed, still closed, and then all of a sudden, look at this. We have lower blood pressure in the ventricle compared to the atrium, right? So which way is blood going to want to flow? It's going to flow from high to low?
Atrium.
It's going to, yeah, so it's high in an atrium, low in a ventricle. Can blood flow that way?
Yeah.
Absolutely. That opens up the atrial ventricular valve. So this point right here is opening of the AV valve. Here is closing of the AV valve. Here is opening of the AV valve. Here is opening of the semilunar valve. Here is closing of the semilunar valve when those pressures cross over each other. That's why this is such a nifty diagram. Okay, so here is closing of the semilunar valve. That makes a noise. Openings of valves usually don't make much noise. Well, if you listen really close, you can probably hear it. Okay, but it's mostly when the valves close. because they slam closed like that. Closing of the semilunar valve makes the first heart sound. What makes the second heart sound? Okay. Closing of the semilunar valves. Okay. So here is closing of the aortic semilunar valve because the pressure in the ventricle is less than the aorta. It's going to want to flow back into a ventricle. All right. So closing of AV, first heart sound. Closing of semilunar here is the second heart sound. Okay. All right. And then we can just see the isovolumetric periods because all the valves are closed. We can see end diastolic volume and systolic volume. The only thing we haven't talked about is the electrical activity on the heart. Sometimes we call this the ECG, electrocardiogram, or EKG. What does that stand for? If ECG is electrocardiogram, what does EKG stand for? Electrocardiogram. That's right, exactly the same thing, right? One is just an old form of saying it, I mean spelling it. And in the hospital, you could be in one hallway and it will say ECG this way. You get to the next hallway, it's going to say EKG, but should you turn around and go back to the first sign? No, it's the same place, right? Okay. And so this is just a measure of electrical activity on the surface of your heart, because remember, every cell is depolarizing and repolarizing, and you add all those cells, the electrical activity of all those cells together, we can measure it on the surface of the heart, and it has some wiggles. There's some changes of this voltage on the surface of your body. Here is the first one. Here's a second, third, fourth, and even a fifth wiggle of this curve. All right, what are we going to call this first one? What is this first change in voltage in this ECG? That is the, well, that's the primavera wave. What does that mean? That's the first one, right? That's all that P really means. That's just the first one. All right, but you got to know what's happening here. What is happening under the P wave is excitation of the atria, right? Which means what? Repolarization, hyperpolarization, or depolarization? Depolarization. Depolarization of both atria caused this deflection or change in voltage on the surface of our bodies. P, atrial depolarization. Okay. QRS complex. All right. We see a lot of different wiggles here. It's got these three waveforms. We usually talk about it all together. All right. This represents excitation of the ventricles. Because remember, we said both atria contract first, followed by the ventricles. And so what is happening here if this is exciting, if the QRS is exciting the ventricles electrically, how do we want to talk about that? Hyperpolarize, depolarize, or repolarize? Yeah, so QRS is depolarization of the ventricles. And we see that that's a much bigger signal than P because your ventricles are much larger than the atria, right? So it's a bigger, much bigger signal. So what happens after depolarization? What happens after depolarization of action potential? You have repolarization, right? So here the ventricles depolarize during QRS. They repolarize during the T wave. So T wave represents ventricular repolarization, right? And you can look at these compared to the pressures and volumes and the heart sounds if you want to. I don't see anything really important to talk about there. All right, so we got depolarization of the ventricle, repolarization of a ventricle. Here is depolarization of an atrium. Where is repolarization of an atrium? You see it here? You don't, because it's buried within depolarization of the ventricle. So it's a small signal. It helps make up some of these little waves right here. But we can never tell what that signal looks like. Right? We can only really see depolarization of the ventricles because they are so huge, because that signal is so big. Can't see it. It's in there. So if somebody asks you and they want to know exactly what the QRS complex is, you have to say it's what? Depolarization of the ventricles, but it is also added to that is repolarization of the atria. It is in there. Okay. But we can't see it. And I guess a really good example of that is if you go outside right now and you look up in the sky, you see any stars up there? You see stars? No, I don't see any stars. I just see a nice blue sky. Don't look at the sun, right? I see a nice blue sky, but are there stars up there? Yeah, they're up there, but you just can't see them because why? Because the sun is so bright, right? Same thing for this QRS complex. The repolarization of the atria is there, but this depolarization of the ventricle is such a big signal, we can't see it, right? Okay, so this is what we call the Wiggers diagram. Make sure that you know how to label all of these things, like ESV, where does it belong over here, right? Make sure that you can match, but use it as an understanding to know when valves are opening and closing, right? And so these valves open and close passively just due to blood flow trying to move across that particular valve. All right, so I'm almost positive this figure is going to be on an exam. Anybody have a question on this one right here? I think you're going to have to work with it for a while. I maybe made a video in Blackboard. Maybe I didn't. Probably somebody should look and see if I discussed this Wiggers diagram for you to listen to and look once again. Questions? Questions? Okay. Just remember, this is pressure versus a heart cycle, volume of a ventricle versus the heart cycle, electrical activity, ECG, with a heart cycle, and then also the heart sounds. Right, so the first heart sound is closing of the AV valve. Second heart sound is closing of the semilunar valve. Right, that's the valve between the aorta and a ventricle. Atrioventricular valve is the valve between an atrium and a ventricle. So I see that on the graph pretty easily, 1 and 2. Okay. I don't see any hands, so I'm going to go back and look at the next PowerPoint slide. The next PowerPoint slide is on the left-hand screen, which is over here. All right, so this illustration is similar. It's got heart sounds, it's got ECG, it's got volume of the ventricles, and it's got atrial pressure, ventricular pressure, and aorta. It's just drawn a little bit differently. This is not in your textbook. This is off the internet someplace. It's pretty good. Heart sounds. Does a normal heart produce sounds? Yeah. How many sounds does it have? It has two. What are they due to? What are the two heart sounds due to? Both the first and the second. They're due to closing of the valves, right? And the first one is closing of which valve? The AV. And the second heart sound is closing of the semilunar. Right, and you can look at those pressure profiles to understand why that is happening. Okay, heart murmurs. The heart can make abnormal sounds. Let me take a look. Oh, good. It can make abnormal sounds because blood isn't flowing in the correct way. So if the function of the heart has changed so that you hear things besides the two normal heart sounds, what else can you tell me about the heart? Okay, if the function of the heart has changed so that it makes a whole bunch of noise, what can you tell me? What else can you tell me about the heart? If the physiology changed, what does that mean? That means, yeah, the structure changed, right? So if the function changes so it makes all kinds of abnormal sounds, then the structure of the heart changes, right? Change the structure, changes the function. If the function changes, we can kind of look immediately for changes in the anatomy of the heart. Okay. A lot of times, the heart will make different kinds of sounds that we call murmurs. Right? It can be due to defective valves. The shape of valves become diseased. Right? And there's a couple different ways that a valve can become diseased. A valve might not open all the way, or it might not close all the way. In either case, it's going to make a sound, and somebody that's used to listening to heart sounds, they could probably tell which one is which. All right. Some of these are congenital. Some of these defects in the valves are congenital in origin. What does that mean, congenital? Yeah, you're born with them, right? That happens during development, and there could be a number of different reasons why it's congenital, right? But these are, somebody's born with those conditions. I got to get my arrow back, okay? Okay. But some are developmental. Sometimes people will have the anatomy of a valve change during their lifetime, and it could be due to improper diet, maybe improper exercise, but it could also be due to infection, right? And it can even be due to maybe some kinds of therapies that you take, maybe chemotherapies. And for instance, because your body will produce antibodies against foreign substances. And every once in a while, Your body will produce an antibody against an infection like the Streptococcus infection. And that same antibody is good because it kills this bacteria, but it also reacts with somebody's valve in their heart. And so what happens to their heart? It gets attacked by those antibodies, right, and damaged, and it can be severely damaged. We call that rheumatic fever, right? And so that is what we call an autoimmune disease. So valves can be damaged by autoimmune diseases. Okay, here's another interesting case. There, when somebody has a cavity, we call that a dental carry. A carry is a cavity. What is a cavity that you have on a tooth in your mouth? What is a cavity? It's due to bacteria that are metabolizing glucose, and then it produces acid. That acid etches a little of the enamel away from the tooth, and maybe even some of the dentin, but it's acid that's eroding your teeth away due to those bacteria. And then somebody had a really ingenious idea. Since you have dental cavities due to actions of bacteria, why can't we just give somebody an antibiotic? Or maybe we can give them a vaccine as a way to fight dental caries, just like you have vaccines for other kinds of viral and bacterial infections. Somebody made a vaccine against the two bacteria that cause dental cavities, Streptococcus mutans and Lactobacilli causes dental caries. And so they've developed a vaccine against these two different bacteria. And of course, before we try this on humans, what has to happen? We talked about this before. There's got to be trials on animals, right? And maybe some molecular studies to see if this thing works, right? And it worked perfectly. And I can't remember if it's rats or mice or something like that. It worked perfectly in the animal model. So these animals never had cavities ever again because they were vaccinated against it. But it was found that that vaccination also caused cross-reactivity with valves. All right, so these animals were vaccinated against these bacteria, never got cavities, but what happened to their heart? That vaccine then killed the heart of those experimental animals. All right, so I guess you have a choice, right? Do you want to keep the valves in your heart, or do you want to have bacteria forming dental cavities in your mouth? Well, it's easy to make that distinction, right? Okay. So mitral refers to what? The mitral valve stenosis is when a valve does not open properly. And maybe it becomes thick, or maybe it has some incrustations on it, like calcium deposits or cholesterol deposits, which makes the valve really hard. And remember, a valve is made out of endocardium. Endocardium is really smooth and slippery, so a valve should be really nice, smooth, and slippery. Because if it's rough, guess what can happen? It can start coagulation. It can start to form clots inside the heart, which is exactly what you don't want to do. Right? So mitral stenosis is when a valve doesn't open up completely. And so then it's hard for blood to go from atrium into a ventricle. That's going to impair diastolic function. And remember, the diastole of the heart cycle is just as important as systole. So that has important ramifications. When a heart doesn't close properly, we don't call that stenosis typically. We call that an incompetent valve. Right? A leaky valve is an incompetent valve. And so there's something strange. It could be due to maybe damage to the papillary muscles. It could also be due to an autoimmune disease, or it could be congenital. Somebody could be born with an incompetent valve, right? But thromboxane A2, we're just,